Well, the thing is, there was a double equation, my age and my romantic ambitions. I don't know how women do it, but I mean, waking up every morning next to someone I don't like because I want to have children that at some point you won't like either is a lot of not likes.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to What I Did Next, a new podcast series from A&T Media. I'm Malak Fouad, your host. In this show, we'll be talking to inspirational guests about those moments in life when you're faced with a crossroads and have to decide which way to go. Do you choose the well-worn, sure route, or do you jump off the deep end and hope it will all work out? Our guests have all confronted this dilemma, and we discuss how this happens and how it changed the course of their lives. My guest today is Sara Trad, a Lebanese hotelier and owner of Beit Trad, an idyllic and luxurious guest house in the mountains of Lebanon. She's also the co-founder of Skoon, the first of its kind drug and addiction rehabilitation center in Beirut. You'll discover on this episode that Sara has repeatedly buckled convention to choose directions that are right for her, even when those choices are at odds with what is expected or considered acceptable. At times, she has found those paths elusive or hard to see, but she trusted that in good time, they would appear, and she was proved right. Sara talks candidly about several career milestones and turning points, but for me, it's a major pivot in her personal life that resonates the most. I found this part of her story incredibly inspiring, courageous, and bold. As always, we're kicking off with one of the show's staple questions. If Sara was hosting a dinner party and could invite five guests, who would they be?
Okay, so I didn't overthink it. I just like spontaneously wrote down who came to mind immediately without overthinking and especially without wondering if they would get along. I'm not sure they would get along, which I usually would do for it. I mean, not overthinking that either. So I would invite Jalaleddin Rumi. Sting.
Wow.
Fanny Ardant. I don't know if you know her. She's a French actress.
I do know her. Yeah.
Barack Obama. Because I wouldn't want him as president, but I'd love to have him for dinner. And Christine Lagarde.
It's an interesting choice. And I think with these lists, you know, I don't think you have to think of it very much as a proper dinner party. So you don't think, will they get along? You just think of who you want to meet. So tell me a little bit, who was your first choice on that?
Rumi.
Why Rumi?
Well, because he inspires me. He's the voice of love and moderation in our crazy, polarized religious world. And, well, the world is not religious. We've made it religious.
He has a very universal quality about him. And he transcends regions and he transcends culture. And he's a lot of people's inspiration, regardless of where they're from. But, of course, especially from our part of the world. He resonates with a lot of people.
He's someone I kind of follow and I would have loved to meet. And when I'm looking at things in life, there's always him and his way that are in the back of my mind. So he'd be in the back of my dinner. Enfin, he'd be in the front of my dinner, obviously.
I'm going to zoom in on a couple of what I consider pivot points that I'd like to talk about, because as you know, this particular podcast series is looking very much at what people do when they're faced with a fork in the road. And I know that you've had two very clear pivot points that I've noticed, and perhaps there are more that you can tell me about. The first one being when you set up the drug rehabilitation center in Lebanon.
Yes, actually, it is one of my pivotal points. The year 2000, I had just graduated as a psychologist from Paris. And I, like every graduate, I looked for a job, you know, sending like those motivation letters and sending applications to places you want. But most, I mean, a few places you want and most of the places you don't really want, but you just want a job. Unfortunately, some people don't have the choice and sometimes you don't have the choice. So I ended up as a headhunter in Paris. I was dating a very nice person at the time, and he said to me, "You're completely depressed since you've got this job. You're completely depressed." I was an employee in a headhunting agency that was small, and the boss became one of my best friends. But all my wings were like, I had no more energy.
It wasn't your world.
It wasn't my world, and I think I realized then and there that I'm an entrepreneur. I'm not good. I'm very, I'm very subdued and disciplined, and I'll go into the job, but it's not my thing. And it kills my creativity and my energy. It's a bit cliche. I'm sounding like a spoiled brat, but it's true.
But I think you have to kind of also at some point follow your instinct. And I think your instinct is quite strong, Sara.
I just realized that I because of everything I was given in life, I needed to make a difference in whatever I was doing and not just take a job to take a job. But making a difference is a big statement. And then I had to live up to it. So I left everything and I didn't know what I was going to. And then I realized that the healthcare and the mental health environment in Lebanon. I was living in Paris at the time. I had been living in Paris for the past 13 years. And so I decided that if I wanted to make a difference, they didn't need another me in Paris. I wanted to go back home and set up a drug rehab and try and bring something to my society that would make a difference to people. And that's how I started.
Had you lived in Lebanon up to that point, Sara? Or had you just gone on
holiday? I lived
1 year.
Yeah. Okay. So I hadn't really. But I had gone back on holidays every year. So I did feel connected, but I didn't feel, I was like a Parisian coming back to Beirut.
Yes. Like a lot of Lebanese, actually.
Yeah. That's the charm of our mix. So that's how I started.
And tell us about setting that up. And did you face a lot of obstacles when you began that? Were you criticized for it?
No. I arrived and we were like 4 co-founders. So I was finding my co-founders. It takes time and you have anxiety, obviously, etc. I didn't really know what I was doing because I wasn't specifically trained in drug rehabilitation.
Right.
And then we had it all set up. We had the program set up and we needed funding. So I said, okay, that's going to take time. It's fine. We need at least funding for 2 years. We need to secure funding for 2 years because we're going into healthcare. And I call my first, the first person I called to fundraise, I needed $220,000. And I call him up and he says, I'm sending you the totality tomorrow in your bank account.
Wow.
That was horrible. I'm like, oh no, what do I do now? That was it. One phone call, I got the totality of the money.
That's incredible.
And I was stuck because then I had to do it. It was terrible. It was, I couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
So instead of, so you see my, my problem was that it was going too fast, which it often does.
It was becoming a reality very quickly. Yeah.
It often does when it's meant to be. It just, things get together and just happen.
Yeah, I agree on that. Absolutely. And the reason for opening it, Sara, was because you had identified a clear need in Beirut and in Lebanon for this?
I had, a lot of my friends were doing drugs and they had no place to go. If you were a drug user at the time, you had, or this drug this rehab where you had to spend a year and a half disconnected from reality, or prison or your home.
Right.
There was no outpatient, so you couldn't continue your everyday life and deal with your drug problem. And there was none of these teams were really specialized in addictions. In the meantime, we set up an addiction degree at the Jesuit University here, USG. There's no degree in Lebanon either. I mean, there was nothing that enabled you to be specialized in addictions.
And the center is still open now, right?
Yes,
it's still functioning.
It's still functioning. It's been 17 years.
And it's an outpatient. That's amazing, Sara. It's an amazing accomplishment. And is it an outpatient only facility?
Yes, it's an outpatient facility. It's very important
and
for us
drugs,
to be outpatient.
Yeah.
It's drugs, alcohol, all kinds of addictions.
Drugs and alcohol, all addictions, basically.
We don't really do food. We do substances.
And are you still involved in the day-to-day running of it, or have
no,
you pulled
I'm
away
not
a bit
involved
it?
In the day-to-day. I stopped the day-to-day in 2007, 4 years in, and I'm head of the board today.
I know that you have another big passion, which is Beit Trad, which is this incredible B&B in the mountains. Tell us about how that came about and what it is exactly.
So the second turning point in my life was 2007, when I decided that I was not excited anymore to be managing Schoon. I love the project, but it's just that my everyday work was not doing it for me. So I quit. I got a job offer that I accepted. And then I also had the idea that, you know, co-founders should be able to, a founder should be able to leave his organization and it should be able to survive him. Otherwise, you haven't.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I left in 2007. The job offer I had taken didn't go through. And I decided that, yeah, fantastic. I was now open to my new destiny, which I didn't know what it would be.
So you basically took a step back to see what would come next.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a step back or a step or a jump into the into
or a jump into the abyss.
A jump into the abyss. 2007, 2008, 2009, nothing's happening. Nothing. My calling wasn't, you know, all my theories were like callings and spiritual. I don't know what.
Yes,
nothing was happening.
Yes.
Nothing was calling.
Your Rumi teachings were not.
Rumi was being challenged. Everything was being challenged, and I decided I had to take my. So I'm going to have to do something myself since nothing's coming to me. So I'm going to be proactive about it, and I decide to move to New York without any project.
Right.
It was one of the hardest phases of my life. I'm laughing, but it wasn't actually funny at all. I moved to New York and I decide to go and do a manouche place, which is basically the dream of every Lebanese that gets off the boat because they crave their manouches. And so, there wasn't, so the idea was fabulous. I still think it's a fabulous idea. And I set up the project. So I raise $1 million that are in my bank account. I set up the project. I find it, you know, the people I want to work with, which is quite complicated in New York because everybody's a shark and you're this white dove coming around. And
of course,
being
of course. So what was it? Was it a restaurant? Was it a
menouche
restaurant?
It was a fast casual concept of menouche. I was calling it the Lebanese pain quotidien or whatever. And it was, it's a very good idea.
It is a very good idea. Yeah. We actually have one in Egypt called Menouche.
There is one now that opened in New York. It's not exactly what I wanted to do, but it was a very good idea. The only problem is it didn't happen.
Right. Okay.
It wasn't happening. I couldn't find the location.
It wasn't working out.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
And instead of letting go and moving on, which I would recommend to anybody, I just stuck with it and said that I had to be perseverant.
You dug in.
And I had to continue, and I had to do this, and I had to do that. It was, and I spent 4 years with, you know, hanging on to this project that was not happening, and that I could call my. I looked it up in English because in French you'd say my traversée du désert. That means my
crossing of the desert. Yeah,
yeah, my dry period, my out in the wilderness. All these. Well, it was
absolutely.
That was it. It was very. Yeah. Hardcore because I was facing my wall. It wasn't happening. I was trying and it wasn't.
But it's interesting, Sara, that you insisted on persevering with it. What made you so determined to keep going with it?
The idea, because the idea was really good. It made so much sense. And then the real estate, it was New York. It was the right time before the real estate boomed again. But now it's down. But we're talking about 10 years ago.
2010,
Yeah, my locations, I had it right. You know, when you're like, but my idea is right. I know it's good. Yeah. And I could see it roll out. And I was there, but it just was not meant to be.
And then what made you, so what happened in the end? You decided to pull the plug?
No, my mom passed away. So 2013, my mom dies. And just this was the third turning point. Because
and it was a very big, big thing, I remember.
It's a very big thing, and I don't know why it was. I mean, I do know why, but it was like I was ravaged. No, I mean, I was annihilated.
You were devastated.
I was more than devastated. I was annihilated. I had nothing. I didn't know what I was. I didn't know who I was called anymore.
Yeah. Your identity was being questioned.
Not even questioned. It was just disappeared. My ego was. I had. You talk about clipping my wing. I had no wings, no feathers, mm-hmm. no skin. I was just completely gone. The good thing, and I was gone, and I was out. I was coming out of 2006 years of nothingness.
So, as they say in French, tu étais à plat. I mean, you were at your rock bottom.
Rock, but like died. Yeah. And I had just moved my stuff from Beirut to New York in January because I was going to live there for the next 10 years because my project was going to happen. And my mom passed away in March. So I went back in May to New York to receive my stuff off the boat and put it on another boat back.
Isn't that strange?
It was crazy. It was crazy. And then I gave the money back to my investors. That's it. New York was over.
Yeah.
And I came back
it
to live in Beirut, which was not in my plans. I wasn't seeing. Anyway, it completely shifted my life.
Yeah.
And then I was in much worse nothingness than I had been before. I was like, I had no clue. I was up in the air and no clue where I was going. No idea. Those are the moments when it's a lot of anxiety because you're in nothingness, but then you're very free of everything else.
When you're at such a low point and at such a rock bottom moment, it's also the time when you can be at your most open to other things.
Exactly. That's absolutely.
And you're so vulnerable that things come to you and, you know, you're open to it.
And then things that you would have said, absolutely no, you don't say absolutely no anymore because anything is good. Not anything, but you're open. I had deconstructed the construction I had of myself was completely deconstructed. So you would have told me 10 years before to go open a project in that house, in a village, in the mountains of Lebanon, I would have thrown myself off the window.
But you know, Sara, I think so much of it has to do with timing as well. I mean, you said 10 years earlier, it wouldn't have worked. You would have been too young, too restless. You wouldn't have considered that a project that you would have found exciting enough, maybe.
That was my answer at the time, is like after Paris, Beirut, and New York, Kfur, this village, sounded very exotic.
Yeah, of course. So tell me, had there been other B&Bs set up in Lebanon?
So it's more than a bed and
breakfast time?
Because we have a full restaurant. It's like a guest house. There, yes, it was a big trend in Lebanon. And I actually did not, that's not why I did it. I did it because we had that mountain house and I needed to save the house. And the house was falling apart.
See.
And after my mom passed, I hadn't taken care of the house. I didn't even go back up and it was literally falling apart. And someone said that houses die.
I believe that.
The vibes of houses die if you
don't
take care of them.
They take the soul of their owners.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course.
So I panicked and I said, I have to do something. And so I set it up as a business because it was the only way to go about it.
To fund the renovations.
To fund the renovation.
And keeping it going.
Exactly. And to make sure that people would go.
And how many rooms is it, Sara? How many guests can you have you have?
It's 9 rooms and I have 2 rooms and sometimes I rent mine sometimes. So it's, let's say, 9 to 11 rooms.
And is the clientele mainly Lebanese or do you attract international people as well?
So we've been open for 2 years and they've been very different years for Lebanon. So my first year I had a lot of foreigners and I had very few locals. I had Lebanese that were living abroad or foreigners.
You said that you have other projects now going as well, or are you focusing on Betrad?
I'm focusing on Betrad and I'm working on developing that kind of concept abroad.
In what part of the world?
My next one, might be in the south of France.
And what is the concept? How does it differ from other sort of guest houses or boutique?
First of all, it's a
small hotel.
It's a Lebanese guest house.
Right. So you'd import that concept to the south of France, for example?
Yes. Well, it would be Mediterranean food, but Lebanese in the sense that it's us. It's our Levantine way of decorating. It's our Lebanese hospitality, it's our generosity, our ways of, you know, eating, living in that sense. And then now I have a team. So my friend and decorator is Maria Osemi, and it would be her. My manager would be. So we have a DNA now, and it would be that DNA that we would be replicating.
The other question I like to ask guests relates to what resonates with them culturally. They have to choose one book, one movie, and one piece of music that holds meaning for them.
I love movies, and I spend a lot of my time in movie theaters. But this year has been a disaster, obviously, on that side, and on many others, but on that side. And so I couldn't think movies, can you imagine? I had no movies coming to me, so I didn't insist either. And I just thought of, when you really like a book, or if a book really inspires you, you kind of have a tendency to give it to people you love. So I was just thinking of books I've given.
That's a great way of thinking about it, because that obviously means that it meant something to you if you want to pass it on to someone.
Exactly. So three books that I've given away through in different times of my life is, you have Fountainhead of
Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand, exactly. You have a book that has the cheesiest title possible, but that I love and was my introduction to Rumi, which is The 40 Rules of Love of Elif Shafak, which is the story of Rumi and Shams Tabrizi, who is basically the dervish that enabled him to come to his own truth, enabled Rumi to come to
his
own
truth. It's a wonderful book.
It really is. I'm not a huge fan of Elif Shafak, but there's something magic about that book, and that something she was really able to transmit. And a third book that I gave away, I think I bought like 20 copies this year, and I've been giving it away because which is Black Wave of Kim Rattas. And for me, it sums up the famous question of how did we get to here today in the Arab world. She answers it in a kind of clear, page-turning way. So it's a book I like
those are amazing choices. In fact, the 40 Rules of Love, going back to that book, it's got a very universal quality to it, because Rumi's message is universal, I think.
But it's not just the question of universal, because a lot of things are universal. I think it's relevant, very much so today. It's something we all need to hear today, I believe. Besides the fact that it's universal, it's also timely. And it's a beautiful love story. I mean, it's a beautiful love story.
Absolutely. And I'm actually reading Black Wave right now, and it's really a page turner, as you said, and it does answer a lot of questions about the state of our region in a very illuminating way. But I really do feel that's another discussion. But we are certainly we have a lot of problems that we can't seem to surmount.
And funnily enough, for people my age, so our age. We were young in 78, we were 4 or 5 years old. So there are so many things that we've taken as givens and never really questioned, never really wondered what was behind them, never really, you know, I mean, so I don't want to go into that, but I was in Saudi Arabia
Absolutely.
At the time. And there are things I took for granted, or truths that were given to me that were actually completely not true. But I never questioned. It was interesting, because she was giving the other version of it.
Absolutely. No, it's an interesting, very interesting point of reference to look at the Saudi-Iran axis, if you like, in the region. Let's talk a little bit about the other thing that you've done, which is, I think we can call it life-changing and certainly pioneering. You're the first person I know in our region who, as somebody who is unmarried, to have decided to have children through a sperm donor. I remember when I heard that through our families, the first thing I thought of was, good for her. I am super proud of her. And, you know, it took a hell of a lot of guts to do what you did. And it's certainly not something that is common by any means. And I was super, super impressed when I heard that. And I just thought, that's really incredible. She's obviously wanted to have a child for a while, and why not? Why shouldn't she do it this way? Obviously, our region has a lot of, you know, prejudices and a lot of preconceived ideas about what's right and what's wrong. And I just want to hear a little bit about how you came to that decision, first of all.
Well, the thing is, there was a double equation, my age and my romantic ambitions. I was incapable of marrying or putting myself with someone that I didn't really get along with just to have children. I find that crazy. I find that very courageous. And I was incapable of doing that. I don't know how women do it, but I mean, waking up every morning next to someone I don't like because I want to have children that at some point you won't like either is a lot of not likes. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I never thought of it from that perspective, but yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
I'm not capable of doing that. So I really wanted to have children. Some people will tell you adding more children to the world, my spiritual belief is that those are souls that are anyway going to come, whether through me or through any other woman, they're coming back on earth. So let them go through me. I have a cool life to offer them.
How amazing.
So in New York, freezing your eggs and taking a sperm donor is not your everyday thing, but your every other day thing. I mean, there's nothing fantastic about it. So I had a few friends there that had done it and pushed me. And my doctor also said to me, I was 39, and she's like, if you want children, you need to get moving.
Wow.
So I got pregnant with a donor at 42. I was doing it for my own self. I also, that was my priority. I mean, I was comfortable with it. I was doing it and I was going to go to the end of it. And I was expecting to tell you the truth. My family supported me, but I would have done it with or without. I was expecting my Beiruti society to throw stones at me. And I was ready to get stoned. I mean, I'm not imposing it. And I understand that people feel threatened by that, especially women that are in marriages that they don't like, looking at me just not, you know, getting my shortcut. And what happened is that women were reacting like you. They're like, yes, go for it. And men. I mean,
men as well.
Yes.
Huh? Yeah.
And
that's amazing.
Because I think also men sometimes feel that women are with them to have children, not for them.
Yeah.
It just made the whole, anyway, it was interesting. I'm not saying that some people have attitudes, some, very few I've had, but I've been supported by 99.8% of them.
And has it been mainly the younger generation that have been, or our generation and younger?
No, the younger generation, obviously. The gay and lesbian community, obviously. That's obvious.
Of course.
No, I had my mother's 80-something-year-old friends that all came up to me and said, yes, good for you, and we're so happy.
That's incredible.
We're trying to convince our granddaughter to do the same. I'm like, no, don't.
That's amazing, Sarah.
Fall in love.
Yeah. That the older generation could see how it could work. That's amazing.
No, because the older generation, I realized that past 70 or something, I'm just giving figures.
Yeah,
people
yeah.
Reconcile with their truth, the social, you know, the social appearances kind of fall. Their lives are, they look at their life from a certain distance and they become more true to themselves or anyway.
And much more philosophical. I think, you know, the older generation, and I think our generation, you know, we've gone through a lot, you know, the Arab Spring, if you like, in our part of the world. I think everyone's reassessed the what is normal and what is accepted and what should be accepted and what you're prepared to live with. And I think there's a massive reassessment of that. And there's a level of tolerance that people have now for other people, you know? Yeah, yeah. And thank God for that. I mean, if that's the thing to come out of the last few years, then that's a very big positive as far as I'm concerned.
No, absolutely. Our systems are still a bit stuck.
Of course, but that's going to take a while. How has it been for you? So you now have a two-year-old girl and a four-month-old girl, right?
I have 2.5 and 4 months, yes.
And how have have you just, has it been difficult to be a single mother, or have you just taken it in your stride?
Well, I have to tell you, there was one thing I was worried about before. I said to myself, there are going to be those moments, and I'm going to, in those moments of, let's say, of panic, or when, you know, you're fed up, or when you're tired, and I'm going to feel lonely. And actually, not at all.
You don't feel that, yeah.
Because I'm not. I mean, first, they say it takes a village to bring up a child. Well, it does take a village. And when you're a single mom, you have a tendency to call the village in instead of keeping the village out.
That's really interesting. Yeah, of course.
Second, when men and women know you're a single mom, they're there for you.
That's right.
You know, they have less of, especially that I'm open, they're there. I really don't feel alone.
Yeah.
And third,
yeah,
when you have a child in general, people have in the most rough cities like Paris, New York, people will help because, you know,
that's right.
And especially a mother will immediately, in our society here, a mother will immediately help you because she knows where you're at. And I have to say that I've realized that being a mother is, there is this thing, you know what the other woman is going through, so you will be there for her. And then Beit Etrad is like the village. So my daughters are brought up by all the staff, all the guests. I have guests that shout at me like, I can't let your daughter do that. And I'm like, it's fine. She's used to the stairs. It's, no. She's not doing that on my watch. I'm like,
yeah. That's amazing. That's adorable.
Yeah, so everybody's
that's really, really cute. So you told me as well that when you did this, you noticed that a few people around you were interested in the same idea and started to follow in your footsteps.
Yeah, my
tell
doctor
me a bit
in New York,
more about that.
My doctor in New York, he now retired, unfortunately. Last year, he said to me, Sarah, now 80% of my patients come from you.
But it's amazing. There are barriers like this that are being broken down around our region. And thank God. Absolutely. Thank God. It can only be a good thing, I think.
Well, it's the same barrier that Rumi broke when he started dancing to, which was whirling to pray as a figure of prayer in a very conservative. He was the head of the ulama, and he was uber conservative, and he was drinking and whirling.
Delighted and thankful that Sara was comfortable enough to share her story with me and with you here. I'd like to thank you for joining me on this episode of What I Did Next from ANT Media. I'm Malak Fouad, and this episode was co-produced by Chirag Desai. If you've enjoyed it, please share the show with your friends and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or IMDb, as it helps more people discover the show. You can also connect with us on Instagram. Just search for What I Did Next. We hope to see you again in 2 weeks' time.